Marcus.
Yes? I've been watching the typing. I thought there were three of them, maybe four.
You need to dump everything now, now, now. What you waiting for, a rainy day? When you think Masha, Zeb are doing right now? Enjoying a beach holiday? Smoking fatties in a hot club? More like experiencing batteries strapped to their nipples.
With normal chat, you get the whole message in a blip. There's a pause, then some text. But this was different. I could watch the typist on the other end typing, the hesitations in the backspaces, even a couple spots where another mysterious typist broke in and tried to interrupt, only to be furiously deleted. There was a lot of texture in this text, and it made it somehow less spooky. These were squabbling people, not all-powerful gods. And the fact that they'd pwned me wasn't an indication of their omnipotence or their moral superiority. I want to dump it all, but I don't want to go to jail. And I want it to make a difference, to put it into stories that people can make sense out of and care about. You've been watching what you're doing. You know why we're doing it. My fear was turning into anger. What's more, we'd be a lot further along if we weren't screwing around trying to do damage control after you decided to start posting without talking to us.
Seriously? You're pissed that we leaked your leaks, weak? Masha trusted you. You didn't have the stones. We do. Suck it.
So what, you just happened to root my computer just in time to get on this little campaign? You only started spying on me at the very second that I started doing something you disapprove of?
When we pwned you is irrelevant. Stop changing the subject. You are too scared to do what needs doing. Time to man up.
Or what? I make one call, and all the darknet passwords will be changed. Give me an hour, I'll have my computers cleaned off. You've got nothing, you little pricks. And without my cooperation, you'll have nothing.
That's what you think.
I kept my face as still and expressionless as I could. Of course they didn't have nothing. In some sense, they had everything. Depending on how much they'd been logging, they'd have my passwords, my email, video of me, audio. And they'd have Ange, too. Her name, her discussing the leaks with me, our makeout sessions. Yeah, you could ruin my life. But then no one will be in a position to help Masha. Is that what you want? I had the sense that there was just one person typing now. Someone I started to think of as final boss, the uber snoop in this little posse. We're going nowhere with this. I'm going now. Going to rebuild everything, change all the passwords. You want to talk to me like people instead of stalkers? You know where I am.
We certainly do.
It took 2 hours to rebuild Lurching Abomination. Almost all of it consisting of painfully slow file transfers from my backups and tedious verification of checksums as I downloaded my OS and all my apps all over again, making sure each time that I had clean copies that hadn't had a single byte changed. I dragged a chair into the wiring closet and did the rebuild there. That gave me direct access to the router and its voluminous, verbose logs. I'd grabbed every packet going in and out of the building's network, a senseless tsunami, a packet storm, a flood. Trying to make sense of the raw feed would be as pointless and brutal as trying to make sense of every mote of dust floating in the air. But dust is analog, and packets are digital. The router couldn't do much by way of large-scale statistical analysis, but it didn't need to. That wasn't its job. VMware had a fine catalog of virtual machines, pre-configured for heavy data crunching. With two clicks, I loaded one onto a cloud VM loaded on Amazon S3, ticking off the private encrypted box. I booted the VM with another click, then switched to VNC, a screen-sharing app. And now I was looking at the desktop of my virtual machine on that little flat screen with its burned-in ghost characters. I had the router throw its monster log file at the machine, and in about 2 minutes, I had all the pretty charts and graphs you could ever want, courtesy of Hadoop, a free data-munging package that did to large blobs of data what Photoshop did to graphics. I knew just enough Hadoop to be a danger to myself and those around me. But by mousing around a lot, I managed to pare away all the traffic except for the streams that were being used to snoop on my laptop. It was hard to tell from a single session, but it looked like the spyware waited a short interval after the machine found a new network, then sent out a little encrypted blip that I figured meant Here I am. A few milliseconds later, my computer got some bits back. I see you. Then, blam, an encrypted stream erupted from the machine. It was encrypted, so I didn't know what it was, technically, though I was moderately certain it was a feed from my screen, my camera, and my mic. Hadoop had a handy traffic analysis library that went further, hazarding a guess that some of the packets were from KPhone, a free Skype-style phone app that did video, and the rest were from VNC, the same program I was using. Which all made sense. If you were going to put together a Trojan to take over people's computers, your fastest and most reliable method would be to just smush together a bunch of highly reliable, well-tested, best-of-breed apps. You could even keep it up to date with the bug fixes the apps released, piggybacking on their development, leaving you with more time to get on with invading people's privacy. I'd be willing to bet that the lawful intercept stuff detailed in the darknet dumps did exactly the same thing. Cops and robbers, all using the same screwdrivers, and civilians in the middle getting screwed. Then I noticed something I should have seen from the start. The ICU message, the screen grabs, and the camera feed were all going to different IP addresses. I punched each one into Google, and of course they were Tor exit nodes. My snoops weren't just encrypting the traffic from my machine, they were bouncing it all over the internet so that I couldn't see where it was going. Somewhere out there was a server like our darknet dump, except it had buttons labeled View from Marcus's camera, Sound from Marcus's mic, and Marcus's screen and Marcus's hard drive. In other words, they'd taken the technology I used to protect my privacy on the net and used it to protect their privacy while they snooped on me. The irony, it burns. That wasn't going to get me anywhere. Meanwhile, Lurch was back up to nominal. I'd even nuked its BIOS, the part of the computer that tells the rest of the computer how to turn on. A tedious process, but I felt like I'd be nuts not to do it. It was considered insanely hard to poison a computer's BIOS remotely, but if I was going to rebuild a computer that had been fatally pwned, ignoring the BIOS would be like changing all your house locks after losing your keys, but leaving all the windows unlocked. BIOS flashed, computer restored, trolls locked out. I shut off all the lights at Joe for Senate, shrugged on my jacket, set the burglar alarm, and stepped out into the cool night of the mission. And straight into the arms of the goons who'd been waiting for me in the parked car across the street. I've been snatched twice. This was not the roughest of the lot. That would be when the DHS grabbed us off Market Street the day the Bay Bridge blew up and clubbed us in the head when we asked what the hell was going on. Nor was it the scariest. That would be when I puked into the bag Kerry Johnstone's squad cinched around my neck, convinced I was going to choke to death on dumpster-dived pizza. It was so smooth and professional, I would have given them a customer service award if I wasn't so busy freaking out. They stepped out of the car in perfect synchrony just as I came through the door. Two guys, big and beefy, with the cop vibe that always made my neck muscles go as tight as a tennis racket. One of them stood at the curb, covering me and watching who was around with a regular predatory head swivel. The other closed the distance between me and him in three quick steps, coming right into my personal space, flipping a laminated DHS ID out of his pocket. Before I could look at it, he'd put it back in his pocket, as neat as a magician vanishing a card. "Marcus," he said, "we'd like to talk to you for a moment." "When in trouble or in doubt?" "I'd like to have a lawyer present," I said. "You won't need a lawyer. It's just an informal chat." He smelled like Axe body spray. It was the perfect gag-worthy aroma for a huge, looming goon. "I would like to see your badge again," I said. "You don't need to see my badge again. Let's go." Run in circles. I took one step up Mission Street, away from the goon, already looking around for passers-by to call out to. A hand like a bar of iron wrapped itself around my bicep and lifted, and I felt like my shoulder might separate as my toes dangled over the pavement. Scream and shout. "Fire!" I screamed. No one in the mission is going to come running if you scream help, but everyone likes to get a good look at a fire. That was the theory, anyway, what they told you in self-defense classes. "Fire!" I screamed again. The goon's other hand covered my mouth and nose with an airtight seal, his thumb hooked under my chin, clamping my jaw shut. Maybe I should have tried help. They did that cop thing when they put me in the car, pushing my head down with that weird, rough, tender gesture so that I wouldn't brain myself on the door frame. but I was 110% certain that these two were not cops, nor DHS, nor anyone else on a government payroll. It was the gear in the car. None of your scarred, scratched, rubberized cop laptops like you got in the SFPD cruisers I'd been handcuffed in. These guys had computers that screamed tactical. That matte black finish and those rugged matte black steel corner reinforcements. Screens fitted with polarized privacy filters that made them appear black unless you were sitting right in front of them. They looked like they'd been designed by someone who'd never seen a modern computer, but had had one described to him by someone who spent a lot of time in muscle cars or Hummers. They didn't just have a GPS. They had a crazy militarized one, with a hedgehog bristle of stubby rubberized antennae and a street map display that showed the familiar streets of the mission using blocky 8-bit style graphics that looked nothing at all like any commercial GPS or Google Maps. They had these crazy armored USB ports set right into the dashboard, each with a pair of LEDs set under hardened glass. There was a strong new car smell, like they'd ordered some kind of fresh spookmobile that morning to stalk me with, something they could douse in gasoline and roll off a cliff when they were through with it. These guys looked like they had money, a lot of it, and weren't afraid to spend it. They didn't look like the sort of people who had to fill in a lot of crazy paperwork to get reimbursed, the way my dad had to do for the books he'd bought for his department at UC Berkeley. The guy who'd been on lookout slid into the back seat with me. I noticed that there were no door handles on the inside of the back doors and wondered how he'd get back out again when he was through with me. This was a distracting thing to wonder about. It took my mind off what through with me might mean. "Hi there, Marcus," the man in the back said. He also smelled like Axe body spray, which must be the national scent of douche-sylvania. He had a disarmingly friendly look. His tight, smooth-shaved face had all kinds of smile lines and wrinkles around his eyes. He projected this air of total relaxation and confidence, like the grown-up version of the most popular kid on the football team character from a bad teen movie. "You can call me Timmy." If we were about to play good cop, bad cop, Timmy was most definitely the good cop. "I'd like to consult an attorney," I said. He smiled wider. "I like that," he said. "That's exactly what she said he'd say, isn't it? She even got the voice down. Man, she really knows you well." She must be Carrie Johnstone, squirreled away in some lair somewhere, eating popcorn and regaling her underlings with stories of my weakness and patheticness. These guys were here to shake me up, get me to say or do something, give them something, the names of the people who had access to the leaks, the passwords or keys, the locations of all the copies. They wanted to scare me. They had scared me. I felt like I could throw up at any second. I felt like I could piss myself. No. You know what I felt like? I felt like I was drowning. Like I'd been strapped to a board, tilted backwards with saran wrap over my mouth, and had water ladled down my nose so that it filled my windpipe. My choke reflex had come to life, sucking hard to try to bring air into my lungs. Each time I coughed, the saran wrap belled out, pushing out some of the precious sips of air left in my lungs. Each time I breathed in, the saran wrap formed a tight seal around my mouth, and the suction drew more water down my windpipe. My lungs began to empty and collapse. My brain began a kind of awful fireworks display, the last lights and noises of a panicked organ about to wither and die and rot. That. I was sweating now, all over my body, and had the feeling of a terrible weight on my chest. It was the weight of the knowledge that I was in the power of someone who believed that he could do anything he wanted to me and never face a single consequence.
"Marcus, buddy, calm down, all right? We're not here to hurt you."
I hated myself for the weakness I was showing. I'd once slept badly, pinching a nerve or a vein or something in my leg, and when I'd stood up in the morning, my leg had given way like it was made of wood, and I'd pitched forward on my face. Now I felt like something else, my inner strength, the place I'd gone to that moment on the playa at the temple, had let me down when I least expected it.
"I would like," I said, voice a gasp, "to consult."
He slapped me. Not hard. In fact, he was almost gentle, but he was fast. So fast I didn't even see his hand move, and had to reconstruct what had just happened from the way that his body shifted, leaning forward a little, then relaxing back, his arm a blur in between. My face stung, but it didn't hurt. "Marcus," he said, and now his voice was stern and paternal. "Enough of that. We're not here to hurt you." "But you slapped me, didn't you?" Of course, he hadn't slapped me hard, and I had no doubt that he could have, had he chosen to. He was a good 6 inches taller than me. Broad-shouldered, and the muscles on his forearms and wrists stood out in cords and masses like a superhero drawing. "We just want to talk to you. If you want to get this over with, you should listen to what we have to say." I stared fixedly ahead of me. "There's something you have, Marcus. Something important. Something that you've been gossiping about to certain urinalists in the big old world. The thing you have, it's not yours. It's our job to get it back. Once we're confident that we have secured it, there will be no further need for us to communicate with you, and no further need for you to communicate with us." I thought about asking for a lawyer again, but couldn't see the point. I kept up my fixed staring. "I understand that a certain party has asked you to publish this material." "What? Oh, right, Masha. That party has changed her mind." I was trying to keep my poker face on, but I suck at poker faces. He saw something change in my expression. "You think we beat her up or something? Forced her to change her mind?" He laughed, a full-throated laugh, like someone hearing a funny joke. And his friend in the front seat laughed, too, a mean little bark of a laugh, like someone enjoying the sight of a stranger tripping and falling painfully. "Marcus, buddy, that little girl was plain worn out from all her rough travel. She was tired of living on tortillas and beans, tired of hiding out in the Badlands. She wanted what she'd had before, 3 hots and a cot, big screen TV and a mini-fridge full of Twinkies, all the luxury stuff. Living large. She didn't want to spend the rest of her life as a refugee, sleeping under a newspaper and eating out of the trash. And hey, we need people like her. Our group? We know her. Some of us have worked with her before. We like what she does. She's good at it. We didn't beat her up. We didn't pull out her fingernails or drip candle wax on her skin. We just offered her a job, and she took it." This was so obviously a lie, I nearly laughed myself. Whatever else Masha was, there was no way she'd sell out to these sick assholes. But, well, how well did I know Masha, really? I'd only met her 3 times, after all, only knew her by reputation, mostly, and it wasn't like her reputation was particularly spotless. Zeb, though. No way Zeb would have gone for it. And I'd seen Masha and Zeb together. They were a unit, or they seemed like it, at least. "That little old man of hers," said Timmy, reading my mind, or my crappy poker face, again. "He doesn't really have much we need. We told her we'd keep him around, though, if she wanted him. It's not like he takes up a lot of room or eats a lot of chow. Everyone's entitled to a pet. But she was through with him. Not that I was privy to the, you know, intimate details. But they had words, is what I'm saying. And he went his way. I bet you think we're the bad guys. We're not, though. We're no monsters. We're good guys, Marcus." "Yeah, because good guys do a lot of kidnapping. Good guys blow up art cars in the middle of the desert and put a whole load of people in the hospital. You're a pack of angels." Thinking it, but not saying it. "What if we take you to see her? We could do that, you know. It's a bit of traveling, though. Could take a while." "You got all your shots?" said the guy in the front seat with a voice full of morbid cheer. "You don't want to go there without all your shots, Marcus." "That's very true. But if that's what it'll take to convince you, we'd be happy to. Who knows, maybe there'd be something you could do for us, too. Kid like you, you're at least half smart, which is smarter than most of the sheep out here. But I don't think you want to go on a long trip right now, do you?" The guy in front started the car and eased out onto Mission, and the guy in back put a gentle hand on my chest before I'd had a chance to move. A pane of opaque glass slid up between the front and back seats, and something happened to the rear windows, rendering them black. The only light came from the little dome light on the car's ceiling. "Where are we going?" I said, and I sounded like a scared little kid, which is exactly what I felt like.
"Just somewhere more private, Marcus. Glad to hear you're up for a little chat, though. So let's talk."
If I were a super spy, I'd have spent the ride counting hills and listening for the telltale cues of San Francisco traffic and figured out exactly where we were headed. but San Francisco is full of hills, and if you can tell one from the other while you're scared to death in a blacked-out box, you're a truer San Franciscan than I am. Timmy hummed softly to himself while we drove. He had taken my jacket and bag, and he methodically went through the pockets of both, taking out every bit of electronics. Laptop, phone, e-reader, a little circuit tester I had stuck in my pocket so I could check on the Ethernet wiring in the office, and remove the battery from each device, then put the device and its battery in a heavy-duty freezer bag and set it to one side. Everything else got a fast but thorough examination and then went back into the bag, except for my multi-tool, a cool little Leatherman Skeletool that I'd coated in candy apple red enamel using the gear at Noise Bridge. He turned that over a few times, brought out the blade and tested it on his thumb. I kept it razor sharp, and smiled and nodded approvingly. "Nice," he said, and I felt stupid pride that this badass ninja goon approved of my knife. Maybe that's the feeling that Masha had felt when she went to work for the DHS the first time around, or when she joined up with Carrie Johnstone and tossed out Zeb, if that's what she'd actually done. The knife went into a baggie on the seat beside him with the electronics. He felt carefully around the seams and edges of my bags, and I realized that he was doing the kind of bag search that you would get at the airport if the people at the airport actually gave a crap about finding stuff instead of putting on a little puppet show about security. The car came to a stop. We'd been driving for a few minutes, or 100 years, take your pick. The divider between the front and the back of the car slid down with that kind of purring near silence of a really well-engineered mechanism. The guy in the front, whose ultra-short hair revealed a gnarly knob of scar tissue that ran from the crown of his head to the tendons standing out in the back of his neck, turned around to look at us. I looked past him, trying to figure out where we'd come. There was water, some dark shapes that might be boats, some industrial-looking buildings. I thought it must be China Basin, a landfill neighborhood that was a mix of abandoned warehouses and factories and trendy condos and offices built into former abandoned warehouses and factories. Judging from the boarded-up windows and the plastic bags and other ancient trash caught in the trees, this was the actual abandoned part. "Well, here we are," Timmy said, and rubbed his hands together. He and the other man exchanged a long look. "Marcus," Timmy said, turning back to me, "you know what the deal is now. We need what you've got back. We'll take whatever steps you make us take to convince you that it's the right thing to do. If you need us to take you to where your little friend is so she can explain the facts of life to you, that's what we'll do." "I don't think you want that, do you? I think you'd like to have this unpleasantness behind you quickly and with a minimum of mess." The other man twisted his face into an ugly smile. "You don't want a mess, buddy. You really don't want a mess." I knew he was saying it to intimidate me, but it worked. "On the other hand," Timmy said, accepting a little bottle of mineral water from his friend and sucking back half of it in one go, "you could just give us what we want, and we could give you a ride to anywhere you'd like to go. You'd be out of this business, we'd get to knock off early and hit the strip bars, and you'd even get a free taxi ride out of it. It's up to you. Are you a smart guy, Marcus, or are you a stupid guy?" I tried to find peace and calm, but it wouldn't come. So I looked for anger, which is an easy place to get to from scared. And yeah, there it was. "You guys are so full of it," I said. "You must think I'm a complete tard. I open up my laptop and nuke the file. And then what? You believe that's my only copy and you let me go? Please, if that file is so important to you, you're never going to trust me." Timmy laughed and thumped the car door. "Oh, Marcus, come on, we're pros. We know how to do this kind of thing. We don't want to take you along with us if we don't have to. Where we're headed, it's a nice place. It's a reward and an honor to get assigned there. The people there, they're elite. You wouldn't fit in. If we have any choice in the matter, we'll leave you right where we found you." I tried again for a poker face. "Yeah, sure they'd leave me. In a garbage bag at the bottom of the San Francisco Bay." "Well, maybe you think we want to off you. Now that wouldn't make any sense. Smart guy like you, you'd have lots of copies where we couldn't find them, but where they'd be sure to come to light someday if you weren't around. We want your cooperation, and we can only get that for so long as you're alive." "And so long as you've got something to lose," the other guy said, bad cop. "Show him," Timmy said. The guy in the front seat got out and walked around the car, closing the door behind him with another well-engineered thunk. The car rocked a little on its suspension as he opened it and got something out. His shoes crunched softly on the ground as he came back around and opened the passenger side door and slid in. He was holding a heavy-duty ballistic plastic equipment case, another tactical black number, with big chunky latches that had worn away a little to show glints of silver metal beneath the matte black paint. He thumbed the latches and opened the case, which made a little gaskety rubbery sound as it opened. It had been filled with foam rubber, with precise cutouts to accommodate a little black box, some wires, assorted discs, some plastic, and clips. "Polygraph," the man said. It was such a pleasant surprise that I found myself on the verge of laughter. Polygraph is the fancy semi-scientific name for a lie detector, a machine that's supposed to be able to tell whether you're fibbing by measuring things like galvanic skin response, another sciencey word meaning sweatiness, and your heart rate. They were invented in 1921, and like many sciencey things, people decided they were so complicated that they must work. This, of course, is an insane reason to believe something. Lie detectors are crap. What they tell you is whether the person they've been hooked up to is sweaty, or whether his pulse has gone up, but that doesn't mean he's lying. Courts don't admit lie detector evidence for a reason. But they're still made and they're still used, for much the same reason that people still wear crystals around their necks to cure their diseases, or buy homeopathic remedies to get better. It's a combination of two distinct flavors of stupidity. I call the first one, it's better than nothing. I call the second one, it worked for me. These delusions are why many big corporations, the U.S. military, and the FBI subject their people to lie detectors. Imagine that you're some kind of millionaire big-shot company executive, the founder of a chain of successful convenience stores. You need to hire a regional manager, and if you hire the wrong person, he or she might rob you blind and ruin you. You need to get this right. So you pay some expensive executive recruiting company to find the right person. They have a big sales pitch. We're smart, we've been doing this for years, and best of all, we're scientific. We have scientific personality tests we'll administer to make sure you're getting the right person. And before you hire that person, we'll wire her up to our lie detector and ask some important questions like, are you planning on robbing the company? And are you a secret drug user? And so on. Science is awesome, right? A scientific recruiting company is going to be totally badass at finding you the right person using the science of hiringology. And their science lab must have a bunch of PhD hireologists. But you've heard that the polygraph is, you know, kind of sketchy. Does it really work? Oh, sure, the consultants tell you. Not perfectly, of course, but nothing's perfect. Polygraphs, though, sometimes tell you when someone is lying. And isn't that better than nothing? The correct answer is probably not. Flipping a coin or sacrificing a goat would sometimes tell you if someone was lying, if you had enough lies and enough goats and you did it for long enough. Now, imagine you're a section chief at the FBI. You got your job by passing a lie detector test. You'd been wired up. You'd been asked if you were a secret communist, Islamo-fascist terrorist dope fiend. You'd said no and the machine agreed. It works! Now, some people out there say that the machine's a piece of crap. But what do they know? After all, it not only worked on you, it worked on everyone you work with. Of course, everyone it didn't work on wasn't hired, or was hired even though they're snorting lines of meth through rolled-up pages of the Communist Manifesto while they strap on their suicide bombs. The world is full of sciencey crap. You probably know someone who wears a copper bracelet to help with arthritis. They might as well burn a witch or cover themselves in blue mud and dance Wittershins under a full moon. There's a chance either of those things will make them feel better because of the placebo effect, when your brain convinces itself to stop feeling bad. But there are an alarming number of people who insist that because something works, it must not be a placebo. It must be real. These guys wanted to wire me up to a lie detector and sacrifice a goat and figure out if I'd lied to them. They were big and tough and rich, they were faster than I was and infinitely better armed, but they'd let a witch doctor sell them a magical lie-catching talisman, and so I was going to absolutely pwn them. They were total dicks about it, too. They watched me enter my password on my computer, making a show of recording it with yet another black rubber tactical gizmo. It was like these guys had an infinite supply of grown-up Tonka toys. a webcam with a white LED that lit my fingers with harsh, uncompromising light as I entered it. They watched as I fired up TrueCrypt and brought up my hidden partition, watched as I did a directory listing and showed them the files, watched as I nuked them. Okay, that's fine, but what about your backups, Marcus? Maybe they weren't totally stupid. I've got a lot of backups, I admitted. But I think I can solve that problem for you. Yeah? Tell me. Timmy was smiling again, all his smile lines crinkling, making him look like he was really enjoying himself and wanted me to enjoy myself, too. I started to get the feeling that Timmy might wear exactly that smile if he was cutting off my fingers or taping electrical wires to my nuts. Well, I encrypt all my backups, of course.
Of course.
And I need a key to get at the backups, right?
Sure. So what if I delete the key?
Haven't you backed up the key?
Yeah, I said. I'll need to get online and erase it in a few places. But once it's gone, everything's gone. It might as well be random noise.
The other guy, Knothead, was holding the webcam with its bright light shining at me, and I couldn't make out his face. But when Timmy shifted his attention to him, he lowered the light, and I saw he was wearing a tactical earpiece. I wondered how many times these guys dropped something small and important on the floor and lost it forever as its black paint job rendered it invisible. I wondered if any of them had been goths in an earlier life. Probably not. Knothead raised one thick finger. He was listening to someone on the earpiece. So the webcam must be streaming over the net to someone else, a technical expert who was watching everything I did, helping them figure out what to do. He nodded twice, said, "Check that," and turned to us. "Do it," he said. "We'll polygraph him later." Timmy said, "I'm about to give you a Wi-Fi password for the car. You're going to get a chance to do what you say you're doing. We're going to see what you do. We're going to verify what you do. If we can verify it, you get to go home. It's that simple. Do we have a deal?" Before, I'd been afraid. Now I was afraid they'd see how happy I was. That was important because what I was about to do depended on them believing that I was very, very nervous. I keyed in the Wi-Fi password and waited while I connected. I wondered what sort of link I was on. I figured if I were them, I'd be running everything through an SSL tunnel to a Tor router somewhere on the net so that everything came through nicely anonymized. Why not? If it was good enough for paranoid freaks like me, it'd suit them just fine. That was the thing about this stuff. It worked equally well for everyone. People who had leaks, people who worried about leaks, people who leaked leaks. We were all smart enough to keep our paranoid packets bouncing around the net like hyperactive super balls. Certainly the connection was slow enough. I waited interminably as my computer logged into the backup at home. "This is my home drive," I said. I typed in the passphrase that unlocked the key on my hard drive and caused it to be sent to the disk on my desk at home. I let the camera see my fingers enter the commands to securely delete the leaks file from my primary backup drive, overriding them with three successive passes of random, or, quote, random, data, then did a search on the drive to show that that was the only copy. That one syncs up to one at the hackerspace, Noisebridge. I logged out and logged into Noisebridge's open shell, Pony, the connection crawling over its layers of misdirection and encryption. "I'm nuking it here," I did. Noisebridge backs up to the cloud. It's not a drive I can control, but Noisebridge resyncs every 5 minutes, and here's where the process logs. I opened up the log file with the tail-f command, which let us see new lines as they were being written to it. We waited in stuffy silence for the next sync, then watched as the log showed the Noisebridge server being compared to the remote copy, noticing that I'd deleted the leaks files and keys, and instructing that they be deleted on the other side as well. I logged out. Done.
"Do we believe him, Timmy?"
said Knothead, in a teasing, mean way.
"Oh, I believe him. But you know what they say. Trust, but verify. Your turn, buddy."
Knothead came around and opened the back door and swapped places with Timmy. He brought out each piece of his high-technology lie detector, examining it minutely, making sure I saw him do it. Back in the days of the Spanish Inquisition, the torturers had a thing called showing the implements, where they showed the heretic the weird cutlery they had on hand to lift, separate, and disconnect all the moist, tender, painful places in his body. Knothead would have made a great inquisitor, and he even had the science background for it. It's a shame he was born 500 years too late to get the job. He fitted me with a blood pressure cuff. Yeah, it was a tactical cuff, which clearly made this guy as happy as a pig in shit, and then started in with the electrodes. He had a lot of electrodes, and he was going to use them all. That much was clear. Each one went in over a smear of conductive jelly that came out of a disposable packet, like the ketchup packets you get at McDonald's. These, at least, were non-tactical, emblazoned instead with German writing and an unfamiliar logo. That was when I started puckering and unpuckering my anus. Yes, you heard that right. Here's the thing about lie detectors. They work by measuring the signs of nervousness, like increases in pulse, respiration, and, yeah, sweatiness. The theory is that people get more nervous when they're lying, and that nervousness can be measured by the gadget. This doesn't work so well. There's plenty of cool customers who are capable of lying without any outward signs of anxiety, because they're not feeling any anxiety. That's pretty much the definition of a sociopath, in fact. Someone who doesn't have any reaction to a lie. So lie detectors work great. Except when it comes to the most dangerous liars in the world. That's the it's better than nothing stupidity I mentioned before, remember? There's plenty of people who start off nervous. Say, people who are nervous because they're taking a lie detector test on which depends their job or their freedom, or someone who's been kidnapped by a couple of private mercenaries who've threatened to take him to their hideout if he doesn't cooperate. But sometimes, lie detectors can tell the difference between normal nervousness and lying nervousness, which is why it's useful to inject a few little extra signs of anxiety into the process. There are lots of ways to do this. Supposedly, spies used to keep a thumbtack in their shoe, and they could wiggle their toes against it to make their nervous systems do the Charleston at just the right moment to make their calm state seem pretty damned nervous. So when they told a lie, any additional nervousness would be swamped by the crazy parasympathetic nervous system jitterbug their bodies were jangling through. Thumbtacks in your shoe are overkill, though. They're fine for super macho super spies for whom a punctured toe is a badge of honor. But if you ever need to beat a polygraph, just pucker up. Your butt, that is. Squeezing and releasing your butthole recruits many major muscle and nerve groups, gets a lot of blood flowing, and it makes you look like you're at least as nervous as a liar when all you're doing are some rhythmic bum squeezes. As a side bonus, do it enough and you will have buns of steel. One of the reasons Noisebridge is such a cool place is that people experimented with stuff like this all the time. Someone heard about the butt-squeezing attacks for polygraphs and told someone else, and before you knew it, we'd found a couple models cheap on eBay and were merrily hooking them up to one another and squeezing. You'd think that you could tell if the person you were talking to was clenching, but you'd be wrong. A little bit of practice, and you can be a perfectly covert anus flexor. "What day is it?" Knothead said. "Wednesday," I said, clenching. This was how you started a lie detector session, by getting the answers to a bunch of questions you knew the answer to, so you could see what the normal, non-lying state looked like. "Is your name Marcus Yallo?" Clench. "Yes." Clench. "Am I wearing a black jacket?" Squeeze. Squeeze. "Yes." "And a black shirt and black pants and black socks and a black belt?" Clench. Clench. "Were you given the tools to download and decrypt a file containing confidential documents by a Confederate at the Burning Man Festival in Nevada?" "Yes." Squeeze. "I was going to have an ass you could bounce quarters off of by the time this was done." "Were you born in San Francisco?" Clench. "Yes." "Do you speak Latin?" "No." Clench. Knothead went on in this vein for quite some time. It was clear that he was going to be ultra sure that he had precisely calibrated his gizmo before he got to the good stuff. "Then, did you delete your copies of this file?" Squeeze. "Yes." "Have you got any remaining copies of this file?" "No." Clench. "Is there any way for you to retrieve a copy of this file or its decrypted components?" "Yes, some of them have been published. I can access those." He snarled, but Timmy laughed. "He's got you there, buddy." "Excluding the documents that are already in the public's hands, is there any way for you to retrieve a copy of this file or its decrypted components?" "Yes, I assume I can still download the encrypted torrent file." Knothead jabbed a finger that was as hard as a steel rod into a spot below my ribs, and a scorching ball of pain radiated outward from the spot, and I pitched forward, gasping, gagging, feeling like I'd puke. "Puke on me and I'll twist your head off and shove it down your neck," Knothead said in an absolutely conversational tone. I kept gasping, but the air didn't want to come back in. Sip by sip, I refilled my lungs. I hadn't thrown up.
Is that going to decalibrate the polygraph?
Timmy said, sounding slightly irritated at the thought. I didn't for a second think that he was irritated with his partner for hurting me.
Nope, said Knothead.
Watch. He reached out and gave me a firm but not hard smack across the face.
Hey, Marcus, you ready for more questions?
Yes, I said, and squeezed automatically.
Are you sorry you were such a smart dick?
Yes, squeeze.
Have you deleted all the copies you possess of the documents you were leaked?
Yes, squeeze.
Do you still have access to the keys to decrypt any other copies you might find?
No, squeeze.
Have you told anyone else about these documents or given copies of them to anyone else?
No, I squeezed. This was the big one. This was the one that determined whether they hunted down Ange or Jolu or my other friends and gave them the same treatment I got and did to them whatever would be done to me. I kept squeezing and releasing.
He showed Timmy the screen.
Timmy cocked his head and listened to the voice in his headset briefly.
Roger, he said.
Knothead turned off the gadget.
It's all good, buddy.
Nice work.
Let's take our little pal here where he wants to go.
Where do you want to go, Marcus?
The malt shop, the drive-in, you got a Bible study class we could take you to? Eagle Scouts?
I can walk from here, I said. I was bathed in sweat and wanted desperately to get out of the car. My eyes kept darting back to the handleless doors. My brain kept thinking, this isn't a car, it's a rolling prison. I was half certain that they were still planning to fill my pockets with rocks and chuck me into the bay. That's what mercenaries did, right? Kill people?
Now don't be like that, sweetie pie, Timmy said. We were friendly enough, weren't we? We're just guys with a job to do. And by the way, that job is protecting your butt from some really bad guys who'd love to blow up your house and put your mama in a burqa. You've done your country a service tonight. You should be proud of yourself.
I didn't say anything. Everything I could think of saying was the sort of thing that would earn me another slap, another punch. Maybe worse.
Where are we taking you, Marcus? You want to come to the titty bar with us?
I'll get out here. He looked disgusted.
Suit yourself, he said.
Knothead ripped the electrodes off me and popped the door. I began to repack my bag, just throwing things in. As I reached for my multi-tool, Timmy snatched it up and dangled it.
You don't mind if I keep this, do you? As memento, you know, of our time campaigning together for truth and justice?
His eyes glittered with lunatic merriment, and he suddenly looked more dangerous than Knothead. I shook my head. Keep it.
Gosh, that's very nice of you, Marcus, he said. Isn't that nice of him?
Knothead laughed. I grabbed my bag and zipped it up, then shrugged into my jacket and set out walking. I didn't know exactly where I was, but it wasn't hard to figure out that walking away from the water would take me towards Soma, and from there I could find Mission Street and walk all the way home, or catch a bus or hop on BART. I got about 20 steps before I heard the car's big engine gun, and then I jumped to one side as the car roared past me, nearly clipping me. It was a final dick move screw you from Knothead and Timmy, a last reminder that I was a little pussy and they were big, tough guys. It was so petty it should have been laughable. But if it was so funny, why did I start crying? Real big, wet sobs, too, and snot running down my face. My hands were shaking and my legs wobbled under me. I felt like my backpack weighed 1,000,000 pounds, and I slipped out of it and let it drop to the ground, not caring about my laptop. I felt like I counted for nothing, like I was nothing. I tried to comfort myself with the fact that they were stupid enough to believe a lie detector, the fact that I'd outsmarted them. It didn't matter. They were bigger, stronger, better funded. They believed in lie detectors because they'd taken lie detector tests, and so had everyone they knew, so they knew that the tests worked. It was no different from people who believed in astrology or faith healing because everyone they knew believed too. It didn't stop these guys from being more powerful and stronger than me. I made myself stop crying, squeezed my eyes shut, and tried to get rid of that scratchy, weepy feeling. I shouldered my bag again. I started walking. I needed to get home, get in touch with Ange and Jolu, tell them about this, tell them about everything. My broken nose ached. It was nearly midnight, and I was supposed to be at work in a few hours with a proposal for turning Joe's campaign into Election 2.0. I had no idea what I was going to tell him. Maybe I'd just tell him the mercenaries ate my homework. I didn't make it home. Halfway to Mission Street, I kept going to market, kept walking to Hayes Valley in Ange's place. I stood at her door, dithering. It was late, and every light was off in the house, and the battery on my phone was dead, so I couldn't even call. I was going to have to ring the bell and wake up the whole house, or I was going to have to go home and spend the night alone. I couldn't face that. I realized I could sit down on the front step, get out my laptop, log on to Ange's Wi-Fi, and use Skype to call her phone and wake her up. It was a perverse way of making a phone call to a person who was about 10 yards away from me, but it was also how I made my cell phone ring when I couldn't remember where I put it. Ange's window must have been open a crack, because as the Skype call rang, I could hear her ringtone, the Doctor Who TARDIS whoosh, whoosh sound floating out over the street. "Who is this?" Skype calls came up, unknown number. "It's me. I'm downstairs. Let me in." "Downstairs where?" "Downstairs here, like right below you." I heard movement over my computer's speakers and through the window and the bones of the house. Ange getting on a bathrobe and coming down the stairs. A moment later, the chain scraped on the door and the deadbolt snapped open, and the door opened, and there was Ange. My computer started to play a feedback squeal as Ange's phone got too close to it, and I flipped the lid shut as she stabbed at her phone's screen with a finger to hang it up. "Marcus? Let me in, okay?" I love Ange. She kissed me hard on the mouth, grabbed my hand, and pulled me inside the house. We went upstairs together, tiptoeing, and before I went into her room, I whispered, "Is your computer on?" She cocked her head at me. "Yeah?" "Go shut it off, okay?" I waited outside her door while she went into her room and moved around. She opened her door, holding her laptop in one hand and its battery in the other. "I think you better tell me what's going on." I thought I'd have the biggest news of the night, but I was wrong. "How sure are you that your computer is safe?" Ange said when I was finished telling her my story. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting her to say at that juncture. "Yes, I'm fine, just a little shaken up, thank you for asking," I said. "Forget that for now. Do you think your computer is clean? Do you trust it enough to get into the darknet?" Only now did I notice what I should have seen right away. Ange was freaked out, too, and not just because of what I had to tell her. "What is it? Do you trust your computer?" "Yes, yes," I said. I woke it up and started typing and clicking. "Search the database," she said. "Look for Zyz. That's Z-Y-Z. "What's a Z-Y-Z? She gave me a don't-ask-stupid-questions look. I typed.